Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. We are less than 24 hours away from one of the most consequential elections in U.S. history. So far, more than 94 million Americans have voted. If you haven't voted yet, you can find out where to vote by visiting voteamerica.com. If you live in a battleground state, be sure to vote today or as early as possible tomorrow. If you have friends or family in battleground states, try to reach out to them and encourage them to vote today or as early as possible tomorrow, because voting rights advocates are very concerned that Republicans will file lawsuits to close the polls even if people are still in line. Again, that website is voteamerica.com. And if you'd rather call to get information, the number is 866-687-8683. That's 866-687-8683. On today's show, we are talking about how tomorrow's election will impact our warming planet. We know that so much is at stake. The past four years, the Trump administration has launched a war on science and climate scientists. He's promised to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. He has dismantled major climate policies, and he's rolled back more than 125 rules governing clean air and water, wildlife, toxic chemicals, and so much more. In Science Magazine, Jeffrey Mervis writes, his handling of the COVID pandemic, his repeated public dismissals of scientific expertise, and his disdain for evidence have prompted many researchers to label him the most anti-science president in living memory. So what is at stake if he is reelected? And what changes will be made under a Biden administration? Joining us to talk about this is Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. Professor Mann is author of the groundbreaking book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and co-author of The Madhouse Effect. Earlier this year, he was elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Hi, Professor Mann. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rose. Always good to talk with you.
Well, it's always great to have you. I can't believe that the election is tomorrow. We have seen massive, massive voter turnout. Professor Mann, can you just talk about the importance of this election and what it will mean for the future of the climate crisis and the planet?
Sure. In fact, I've been pretty outspoken in stating that this is a make or break election for the climate. Another 4 years of Trump and his policies would essentially be game over for the climate, in the sense that it would make it very difficult for us to stabilize warming below truly dangerous global levels of warming, to keep warming below a degree and a half Celsius, roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Beyond that level of warming, we will start to see the worst impacts of climate change, but we can still avert that sort of catastrophic climate change if we take action, dramatic action, over the next several years. And another 4 years of Trump would basically ensure the impossibility of that scenario.
Professor Mann, can you talk more about that? Why would this be game over if Trump is reelected?
Yeah, so we need to reduce carbon emissions by about 7.5% a year for the next 10 years if we are to remain on a path that keeps us below that catastrophic 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. Coronavirus, the lockdown, social distancing, these dramatic changes that we have undergone over the last, the better part of the last year now. Despite how dramatic a change that feels to us in our lifestyle, that'll only get us maybe 5% reduction in carbon emissions for the year. We've got to go beyond that. We've got to be reducing them by at least 7.5%. And that's every year. This year, then another 7.5% next year, and so on for the next 10 years to keep carbon levels, again, below what gives us that catastrophic planetary warming. So we obviously need policies that will incentivize a shift away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. The United States is one of the two largest emitters, one of the two largest carbon polluters on the planet, along with China. If we don't live up to our obligations under the Paris Accord, it's very difficult to see the world achieving those reductions. Moreover, if we refuse to take a leadership position on this issue, then it really makes it easy for other countries to, you know, basically to not live up to their obligations as well. We need to set an example as one of the largest two emitters and the largest historical emitter. We've put more carbon pollution into the planet than any other country. And so it is incumbent upon us to set an example for the rest of the world. And Donald Trump, of course, does just the opposite. In fact, under Trump, we are the only country to go back on our commitment to the Paris Accord.
In September, Politico wrote that Trump's rollback of Obama-era climate regulations will cause the United States to pump an extra 1.8 billion tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere between now and 2035. This is based on a forecast from the climate research firm Rhodium Group. It's one of the most detailed and comprehensive estimates to date of how Trump's regulatory U-turn will affect the amount of planet-warming carbon dioxide coming from, you know, everything from tailpipes to power plants. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yeah, I mean, again, it ties into that number that I gave you. Right now, the world pumps about 60 billion tons of carbon dioxide pollution and carbon equivalent, methane and other greenhouse gases, 60 billion, we call that gigatons, 60 gigatons of carbon dioxide pollution every year. We've got to get that down to below 30 within a decade. And the United States, again, is one of the two largest contributors right now. So it's difficult to see a path to getting those numbers down as much as we need to get them without the United States doing its due diligence and living up to its obligations to reduce carbon emissions. Now, let me make a point here. Paris, the Paris Agreement, the Paris Treaty, 4 years ago, that was a really monumental achievement. But Paris doesn't get us where we need to go. It gets us a little less than halfway where we need to go. So at a time when we need to actually be ratcheting up our commitments, when the rest of the world needs to be ratcheting up its commitments to go well beyond Paris, if we're going to achieve those reductions, again, Trump has literally taken us in the opposite direction, backing out of our global obligations and undermining, as you alluded to, environmental protections in the United States that were put in place not just by the prior Obama administration, but clean air and clean water policies that were put in place by past Republican administrations.
Hmm. Professor Mann, you have done such an amazing job of really explaining all of this to the public. You were recently on 60 Minutes. You are constantly on social media writing op-eds. What are your thoughts about just how things have really changed over the last, you know, 4 years in terms of how the public really understands these issues?
Yeah, I think we've really seen a sea change. And I'm just one of, you know, a number of scientists who have, you know, embraced, you know, the importance of not just doing the science, but communicating it and its implications to the public. Because if we don't do that, we leave behind a vacuum that'll be filled by the voices of misinformation and disinformation. And so I think it's important for many of us scientists to try to, you know, contribute to the public discourse over this issue. But I'll tell you, what gives me optimism is the voice of our youth, the youth climate movement, of course, Greta Thunberg, but all of these other youth climate activists who over the past several years have really recentered the conversation where it needs to be. This is a matter of ethics. It's not just science and economics and politics and policy more than anything else. It's a matter of ethics, intergenerational ethics, our obligation not to degrade this planet irreversibly for our children and grandchildren. And there's still time to do that. Unfortunately, the children don't have a voice, right? And they don't have the same voice that we have when it comes to voting and contributing directly to our politics. But they do have a voice, and they've used that to convince the rest of us that we need to, you know, take a leadership sort of position here. You mentioned in the lead up to this segment the importance of voting. This is a make or break election. And, you know, our children can't vote. And so we have to do that for them. We have an obligation to vote for them, to vote for politicians who will support action on climate, and to vote out those politicians who refuse to act. And that's true at the top of the ticket, with a choice between a denialist president, Donald Trump, who threatens global action on climate, and Joe Biden, a Democrat who has put forward a bold climate plan. So that's true at the top of the ticket, but all the way down the ticket, we need to vote for politicians who will do what's right for us rather than politicians who are simply a rubber stamp for polluters.
To your point, Professor Mann, the Washington Post just ran a piece called "The Climate Crisis Spawned a Generation of Young Activists. Now they are voters." I mean, I'm getting emails from the Sunrise Movement on a regular basis, and they're really credited with helping Senator Ed Markey, co-author of the Green New Deal, beat back a Democratic primary challenge in Massachusetts from Representative Joe Kennedy in September. Sunrise volunteers made 200,000 phone calls for his campaign.
Yeah, you know, as somebody who was born and raised in Massachusetts, I have to say that was a tough one to watch two heroes, Ed Markey and Kennedy, going at each other. But Markey really was, you know, the climate hawk, in that election. He had a far more ambitious stance on climate, of course, played a major role in at least one version of the Green New Deal that has, that has been circulated and considered. And so, yeah, you know, the children are doing it. You know, some of them are old enough now to vote. My first year students at Penn State, I remind them every class, this is your first opportunity to participate in this way in the political process. And what an election to be able to play a role in. So some of those younger folks are coming of age, are able to vote. And even those that aren't are making a difference by putting pressure on politicians to do the right thing.
Today, we are talking about what is at stake for the climate with tomorrow's election. We're joined today by Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. If you have any questions for Professor Mann about what is at stake, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. He says if Trump is reelected, it would be game over for the planet. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Professor Mann, how do you make sense of the 125 environmental safeguards that have been rolled back under Trump? The New York Times has done great coverage of this. The Washington Post just had a piece saying that the administration has allowed more pollution, drilling and logging, while weakening protections for animals such as bees, bears, and birds. We've tried to do our best to cover this. I mean, we could probably take almost a day to do all 125 because they're so important. But how do you even begin to wrap your head around this?
Yeah, and the scary thing is that's just the tip of the veritable iceberg. Given another 4 years, of course, he will, and let's be clear, Donald Trump, who really knows what he thinks about the environment, about climate change? It doesn't matter because he has outsourced his environmental and energy policies to the polluters, to the Koch brothers, fossil fuel lobbyists who are handpicked by the Koch brothers in the fossil fuel industry. He has delegated his environmental policies to polluters, and they are busy, as the Trump sideshow has continued and he distracts us with our antics. They have sort of more quietly but steadily been dismantling all of the environmental protections, not just put in place, as I said before, during the last administration, the Obama administration, but going back to the Reagan, the Bushes, Nixon, environmental policies that were actually put in place under Nixon, clean air, clean water laws. So, you know, given another 4 years, the damage will be, you know, irreversible. And that's why I say that it really would be game over for the climate in the sense of keeping climate change below truly catastrophic levels. We only have one shot at that. The next few years are going to be pivotal if we're going to reduce our carbon emissions fast enough, if we are going to decarbonize our economy fast enough. And we can't afford another 4 years of Trump. It's that simple.
Well, now I would like to welcome Naomi Oreskes to the show. Naomi is professor of the history of science at Harvard University, a writer at Scientific American, and author of the new book, Why Trust Science? Professor Oreskes is co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Climate Change, and she's also featured in the documentary by the same name. Hi, Professor Oreskes. Thank you so much for joining us again.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. We're one day before the election, and Professor Mann says if Trump is reelected, this would be game over for the climate. What would you like to add? What are your thoughts?
Well, I guess, you know, Mike and I do a lot of things together, and we always agree about 95%. So it's always a little challenging to figure out what can I add that's useful. I think the only thing I would want to add is that even if Trump isn't reelected, we have a big uphill climb ahead of us. You know, we've lost 30 years to delay, disinformation, prevarication, and all the rest. And the situation now is quite grave. I mean, I think that's what Mike's getting at when he says that, you know, we're on the edge of game over because we have no time left to squander. We've already seen practically all of the predictions that scientists made back in the 60s and 70s, they've come true. Heat waves, droughts are worse, wildfires are worse, hurricanes are worse. People are getting hurt, people's houses are being destroyed, communities are being dislocated. I mean, this is getting close to a kind of worst case scenario, something that is quite a bit worse than the scientists that I've studied who, you know, first wrote about this in the 60s and 70s imagined would happen. So I think it's important for all of us to recognize that even if Joe Biden gets elected, we have a big uphill battle ahead of us. And we've got to really work hard to figure out what do the steps look like. And, you know, when Biden made that comment about transitioning to, you know, away from fossil fuels, which then Trump tried to claim was a gaffe, and then some of his people tried to, you know, walk back. I mean, obviously, I think we all understand the realpolitik of Pennsylvania. We understand, you know, why he has to be cautious about what he says. But the reality is that it wasn't a gaffe. It was exactly correct. We have to transition away from fossil fuels, and we need to figure out what that looks like, and we need to figure out how to do it as fast as possible while still taking care of, you know, the people, the workers in the fossil fuel industry and keeping them whole. And I think that's the big challenge that is in front of us, even if we get a Democratic administration. And if we don't, well, then all the things that Mike just said.
You know, Professor Oreskes, I remember you were on the show, I don't know, the last couple of years, and I asked you, you know, what are maybe three things that you would change immediately? And you talked about fossil fuel subsidies, and we talked about why this doesn't get more attention in the media from politicians. And now here you have Biden say he is going to get rid of fossil fuel subsidies. And according to the price of oil, internationally, governments provide at least $775 billion to $1 trillion in annual subsidies. And I'm looking for the number for the United States. We'll find that in a minute. Do you know it off the top of your head?
You know, I used to know it. I feel like my brain has been so crowded with facts and figures that it's all like started pouring out my ears. So I don't, but it's a lot.
Okay. I found it. It's 21 billion. The United States spends 21 billion every year to produce more fossil fuels. What are your thoughts about just how that was covered and just how that was received?
Well, first of all, I want to say, I think it's incredibly great that Joe Biden is finally talking about this issue because it's absolutely crucial. As you said, we know that fossil fuels are massively subsidized. And yet most Americans think the opposite. They think that renewable energy is incredibly subsidized when the truth is the opposite. And I found that when I talk to people about this issue, people are very shocked to hear that. And then if you say, so, you know, if we could just get rid of these subsidies to fossil fuels, let renewables compete on a level playing field, that's a message that a lot of Republicans and independents are very open to. I mean, a lot of people who are skeptical about climate change are skeptical because they think they're defending the free market. And when you point out to them that fossil fuels are anything but, that the richest corporations in the world are getting huge amounts of taxpayer subsidy, that is a winning issue for most people. Now, the tricky thing, of course, as you know, and I think this is part of the answer to your question of why the press doesn't cover it more, it's really geeky, right? And this is something that, you know, I've faced a lot in my own work. When you try to talk to people about concrete solutions, you very quickly find yourself down in the weeds. You're talking about fossil fuel subsidies. You're talking about, you know, external costs, internalizing the external costs. And so one of the things that I like to do when I talk about these things is to acknowledge that it's geeky. Sometimes when I talk to my audiences, I'll say, I need to talk about something really, really sexy. It's fossil fuel subsidies, you know, and that at least gets their attention. So we need to acknowledge that these things aren't exciting, but they really, really matter.
Right. Professor Mann, what would you add?
Yeah, well, again, the downside of a joint interview with Naomi and me is that we agree on so much, and I guess the challenge is just to complement what each other is saying. I would add that that this is sort of one of the challenges: pipeline protests and protesting the removals of mountaintops to get at coal. Those are very visual. They command a lot of media interest, and the challenge is that many other aspects of the solution. Yes, we need to sort of deal with the problem on the supply side. We need to stop allowing for continued building of new fossil fuel infrastructure that just locks in more carbon emissions. But at the same time, and it's not quite as visual, it doesn't create the same sorts of headlines as having celebrities arrested at a protest. And yet it's every bit as important to make sure that we have market incentives and disincentives. Just as Naomi said, part of the problem is that not only don't we have incentives in place to help speed up that transition away from renewable energy, towards renewable energy from fossil fuel energy, we actually have the opposite. We're providing explicit subsidies for fossil fuel energy. And that's not even taking into account the biggest cost of fossil fuel money, of fossil fuel energy, which is the damage it is doing to us and the planet through the climate change it's causing. Even, even if we don't take that into account, we're still providing incentives for, planet destroying energy production and not providing incentives for renewable energy. So, how do we do that? You asked about the things that we need to do. We need to stop, allowing, green lighting new fossil fuel infrastructure, new pipelines. Yeah, we need to attack this problem from the supply side, but also on the demand side. We need to put a price on carbon, and we can talk about how that would best be done, and it should be done in a just way. We don't want frontline communities, those with the least resources, to pay the price, but we need to level the playing field by putting a price that you can't pollute into the atmosphere and destroy our climate for free. Price on carbon and subsidies and other incentives for renewable energy to speed up the transition that's already underway. That's the good news. We're already seeing carbon emissions peak and they're starting to come down. And a big part of that is the global move towards renewable energy, but it's not happening fast enough for us to achieve the reductions we need to avert catastrophic warming.
Well, let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Ralph in Palo Alto. Hi, Ralph. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, this is just a quick question. I was wondering if the experts could comment on the likelihood of the large insurance companies getting into this fight. So many documents have been discovered about Exxon and other companies knowing of climate change. I know at least since 1975, and this year I know I've read we have had a record number of multi-billion dollar natural disasters, from hurricanes to fires to other things. And I'm just waiting for the big insurance companies to enter the fight, because they will be a very powerful ally.
Thank you. Professor Oreskes, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So we do know that the large reinsurance companies, particularly Munich Re and Swiss Re, have been on this issue for a long time. And they've been working behind the scenes with a lot of the businesses with whom they work to deal with climate risk and to price climate risk. We've seen the retailer insurers less willing to stand up and be counted on this issue. And I think this is part of a bigger pattern that the business community in general has been sitting on its hands on this issue. And I think this reflects that many businesses are afraid to stand up and be counted because they're afraid of antagonizing maybe some part of their consumer base. But this is part of the big problem that we face, that the business community doesn't speak up, but the fossil fuel sector does. And you know, I've spoken a lot about this issue with Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island. And one of the things he says is that whenever there is any climate relevant legislation pending in Congress, the fossil fuel industry is all over it, and their lobbyists are all over it, and they're there pushing, pressuring, threatening, cajoling, and the rest of American business is nowhere to be found. So I think that it's really, really important that people in the business community realize that their voices need to be heard, because lots of businesses are threatened by climate change. The fossil fuel industry wants business as usual, but for most of the rest of us, including small business owners, hotels, climate change is not going to be good for business. And the sooner that the business community can become more actively engaged in this issue, the sooner I think we can help to break through some of the partisan gridlock that we have seen and have meaningful, sensible policies put in place.
Do you have anything to add, Professor Mann?
Yeah, sure. You know, there's a little bit of good news here. And this was something that really struck me during a sabbatical I was down under in Australia earlier this year. To research the linkages between climate change and extreme weather events, having no idea that I would arrive to see the most profound example of that in the form of the unprecedented bushfires that blanketed the country at the time. And so I ended up witnessing that firsthand, but I also had a number of meetings with what are known as Superfund managers. In Australia, employers are required to put a certain amount of basically retirement funds into these super funds, these very large mutual funds, essentially. And as a result of that, Australia is one of the leaders in the world when it comes to these superannuation funds. And there's a huge amount of investment that they are doing. That makes their decisions extremely important. If these super fund managers and if the investment banks and Bank of England and BlackRock, you know, we've heard stories about this over the last year, some of the large movers and shakers in the finance industry, some of the large investment banks that are saying, look, you know, there's a carbon bubble. We are going to need to decarbonize, you know, our economy, and that makes fossil fuel investments bad. Moreover, we have a fiduciary responsibility to those whose funds we're managing, to make sure that we don't make decisions that will be bad for them and future generations. We shouldn't be investing in fossil fuels. And as a result of that, we are seeing some of the large investment banks, some of the large superannuation fund managers, asset managers, starting to decarbonize their portfolio. There was one of the more significant developments earlier this year when BlackRock, one of the largest in the world, said that they are now in the process of decarbonizing a substantial part of their investment portfolio. So there's a little bit of good news there. The business community, parts of the business community, are starting to take a firmer stance here, but we need to see more of that. We need to account, to demand greater accountability on the part of the business world. It needs to be a partner in this necessary transition to save our climate.
Well, thank you for the call, Ralph. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are joined by Michael Mann, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State, and Naomi Oreskes, Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about what is at stake for the climate crisis with tomorrow's election. If you haven't voted yet, be sure to try to vote today or to vote as early as possible tomorrow, especially if you live in a battleground state. You can find your polling place or a drop-off box at voteamerica.com. You can also call 866-687-8683, 866-687-8683. Today, we're joined by Michael Mann, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. He's co-author of The Madhouse Effect. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University, a writer at Scientific American, and author of Why Trust Science. And if you have a question for our guest, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have a question from Rich. He says, how confident can those of us who are not scientists be in the emerging science of attribution, particularly when we look at the rapidly melting Arctic, the burning up of so many Western forests this year, and the strength and frequency of hurricanes that have recently and repeatedly been hitting the southern states along the Gulf of Mexico? Professor Oreskes?
Well, I think, you know, like a lot of things in science, the answer is pretty confident. And I think, you know, Mike might want to get into the details of how detection and attribution studies work, but the way I view it is really pretty simple. And it comes out of the basic history and philosophy of science. You know, we've all learned that one of the ways that science operates is by making predictions and seeing whether or not those predictions come true. Back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, numerous scientists predicted that climate change would lead to worsened hurricanes, to worsen droughts and crop failures, to worsen wildfires because of decreases in soil moisture. All of these things were predicted, and now they're coming true. Now, that by itself doesn't prove that any one particular event was made more likely or worse by climate change, but it's a strong reason to accept it, because this question was posed in the question of confidence. It's a strong reason to be confident in the scientific results, because we see these predictions that were made decades ago now coming true. Mike might want to add about any particular specific event, but the broader question about confidence, I think we can answer very clearly.
Professor Mann?
Yeah, so in fact, Naomi and I co-authored an article a few years ago about this very topic. And, you know, we make the point that if anything, and it's part of the culture of science, and Naomi has written extensively on this, sort of a culture of reticence, that in many respects, the way these, you know, detection and attribution studies are designed, they're sort of biased toward rejecting a connection between climate change and, say, certain families of extreme weather events. Now, some of my more recent scientific research has involved some of the processes, understanding the processes by which climate change is leading to some of these extreme weather events, the sorts of floods and heat waves and superstorms and droughts and wildfires, of course, in California and Australia. And it turns out that the models, in some respects, aren't capturing some of the mechanisms that we think may be important in the real world in linking climate change, in making these events more frequent and more extreme. And it has to do with some sort of fairly technical issues about how the behavior of the jet stream and the waves that make up the jet stream behave when you change patterns of temperature on the planet. But the bottom line is the models, if anything, are probably underestimating the impact that climate change is having on many of these extreme weather events. And so it's worth keeping in mind that, yes, there's uncertainty, but it's not our friend. When it comes to sort of resolving the uncertainty and better understanding the relevant processes over time, if anything, we're finding that things can happen faster, that the impacts can be even greater than we thought.
Oh, yep. Are you still there?
I am.
Yep, I'm here. Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Well, we have a related question from Greg, who says, can you give us links and references to the best estimates of annual costs of climate change, both today and going forward, Professor Mann?
Yeah, so there have been estimates that have been made by various organizations. I'm drawing a blank on I don't know if it's the World Economic Forum, but there have been.
I could jump in the IMF.
International Monetary Fund. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, and as Naomi and I can both tell you, these are likely to underestimate the impacts of climate change because the science of attribution is still developing. And so when you get an estimate like, you know, $1 trillion of GDP, and it's a huge you know, amount of money. And that's what, you know, the IMF has come up with, an estimate of more than $1 trillion globally in gross domestic product, you know, more than 1% of the global economy. Well, you know what? It's probably much more than that. The basic assumptions that go into, you know, obtaining these sorts of numbers, by necessity, are missing a lot of the impacts that, you know, we're still untangling. And, you know, nowhere is that more obvious than in the case of extreme weather events, the sorts of wildfires, the hurricane season that we're facing right now, the toll that's taken in tens of billions of dollars here in the United States every year, to the extent that the models aren't yet quite connecting climate change to these impacts in the way that we think they are connected in the real world, those estimates are coming in low. So we should be skeptical, but we should be skeptical because if anything, these estimates are likely to be too low.
Well, anything to add, Professor Oreskes?
I'd like to jump in on that. So yeah, there've been important studies done by a number of economic organizations, including the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, but probably the most important study that's ever been done on this was the Stern Report, which it was published originally in 2006, but it's still relevant. And one of the things that Nick Stern and his team found, and Nick, by the way, was the former chief economist of the World Bank, so nobody can accuse him of being a socialist or a Greenpeacer or something like that. So in the Stern Report, which was commissioned by the UK government, found that the cost of preventing disruptive climate change might be something like 1% of GDP. Now that's a lot of money, but they also found that the cost of not preventing it, the cost of the damage, could be as much as 20% of GDP. And that is truly catastrophic. And so that report, I think, is still the benchmark for studies of this time. Since then, Nick Stern and others have done further work. And actually, Nick and I published a piece in the New York Times about, God, I don't know, in the land of COVID, it's hard to know when anything happened. But I want to say 8 months ago, a year ago, something like that, maybe it was a year ago, in which we talked about why economists were underestimating the costs of climate change. So just as natural scientists, physical scientists have tended to underestimate the rate at which climate change has happened or be conservative about attributing extreme weather events to climate change, we've also seen a number of ways in which economists have been conservative in their estimates. And Nick and I outlined a number of specific points in which we could show reasons why economists had tended to underestimate the cost of climate change. So we know that the costs of damage are already very great and getting greater. And the cost of fixing it is not trivial. It is true that fixing this is going to be expensive, but it's still going to be a lot less expensive than doing nothing and continuing business as usual.
Hmm. Well, I can add one. Oh, go ahead.
Point to build on what Naomi has just said. One of the underlying assumptions in just about all of these estimates is that the economy just sort of goes along, continues to grow at some percent, some historical rate. And so economists use what's known as social discounting. And the idea is, well, hey, you know, one of the ways that we can solve these problems is by just letting the economy grow. And if it gets large enough and we have enough wealth, hey, we can fix any problem we might create. Well, that is a very tenuous assumption. And so this entire assumption that climate change impacts can be treated as if they're just some percent tax on the economy, a 1% tax on the economy, a 2% tax on the economy, that may be fundamentally flawed because ultimately there is no economy on a dead planet. And while that's an extreme statement, the point is that if you do create conditions that favor societal collapse, and we can't rule that out, you know, if we continue with business as usual, the worst case scenarios ultimately would involve a collapse of society, of civilization as we know it, then there's no longer an economy. So we have to recognize that even some of the basic assumptions that go into these studies are overly conservative and biased towards, you know, the null hypothesis, if you will, that somehow action will cost more than inaction. It's just the opposite. Not acting will be far more expensive than acting, and maybe tragically so.
Mm-hmm. That is Michael Mann, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. Naomi Oreskes is Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about the impact the U.S. election will have on a warming planet, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we shift gears and talk about what you both would like to see under a Biden administration, and you know, what's most effective for the grassroots, I'd love to get your thoughts, Professor Oreskes, given that you focus so much on public trust in science, and I just wonder how you're thinking about how Trump has really damaged the public's trust in science, making fun of COVID, railing against masks. I mean, it's just still so shocking to me to see all of these people crammed together at his rallies, no distancing, no masks. He makes fun of renewable energy. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yes, well, we live in difficult times, or we live in interesting times, I guess we could say. But I guess one way I like to think about it is that as bad as Donald Trump is, and as nasty and condescending as he is, this didn't really begin with him. And I think that if we're going to fix it, we have to take the longer view, and we have to come to grips with the way the Republican Party has systematically disparaged scientific work in a whole set of areas long before Donald Trump, going back to Ronald Reagan's dismissal of the evidence of acid rain, his removing of solar panels from the roof of the White House. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, and the Republican attack on scientific expertise, Republican attempts to undermine scientific independence and agencies, none of this is new. It's reached a kind of extreme under Donald Trump, and he's so brazen about it that I think the brazenness is shocking. But actually, what he's doing is the continuation of policies that we've seen for a long time. And so maybe the one good thing about the brazenness is that it's actually forced us to talk about it in a way that many people didn't do when not that different things were happening, say, under President George W. Bush, for example. So brazen, it is terrible. It isn't clear how we get out of this mess. But I think a full accounting is necessary, because I think there are an awful lot of Republicans have been kind of sitting on their hands about climate change denial. They know climate change is real, and they know it's hurting people, but they've been afraid to step out from the mainstream position of their party. And maybe now, with all the damage that Trump has done, you know, in the close to 250,000 Americans who are dead, you know, maybe that will encourage some Republicans to step forward and say, we can't keep doing this any longer because the American people are dying.
Professor Mann, what would you add?
Yeah, you know, this is something that's been going on for some time, as Naomi alludes to. And, you know, it's almost ironic to those of us who have been working in the climate space for decades. I mean, you know, being attacked as a scientist by, you know, ideologically motivated individuals and think tanks and politicians in the pay of, you know, of powerful vested interests. To some extent, this is new to the public. They hadn't really witnessed this, you know, writ large until the effort to discredit Anthony Fauci by Trump and the Republican establishment. But it's been going on for decades, and scientists like myself have been at the receiving end of the same sorts of attacks now, literally for decades. It's something I talk about in my new book, The New Climate War, which is sort of about how, as we get past outright denial, because it's just no longer plausible to deny that something's happening, we're facing a whole new array of tactics that are aimed at forestalling action on climate. Yeah, it's real, but you know what? We can come up with some simple techno fix that'll be real cheap. Geoengineering, or coal capture and sequestration, or natural gas, or hey, you know, doesn't require regulation, it doesn't require policy, it doesn't require pricing carbon or incentives for renewable energy. We just need to be better behaved as individuals. We have to mind our own individual carbon footprints. And I could go on and on. There's a whole new array of tactics that ultimately are intended to lead us down the path of inaction, despite the fact that it's now obvious that climate change is real, human-caused, and a problem.
Well, we have a related question from Scott in Berkeley. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is a wonderful discussion, and I'm going to be seeing my otherwise lovely family over the holidays, who happen to be Fox News watchers and do not believe in climate change. What could you tell me would be like a 1-minute elevator pitch to just try and open their hearts and minds?
Thanks, Scott. Professor Mann, do you want to take that first?
Sure. You know, it's you always have to sort of figure out where they're coming from. Is this genuine skepticism, or is it really an outgrowth of an ideological position, sort of the tribal position of today's Republican Party, that you have to deny climate change to be a good, you know, conservative? So often what you'll find is that it's not really about the science. And so if they, you know, you can try to address each of their talking points. And there's a great website, and you can, you know, access it on your smartphone, skepticalscience.com, that has a list of all of the standard myths and what the actual science says about them. So, you know, when you're at Thanksgiving, you say, well, you know, Uncle Charlie, that's actually number 2 on the skeptical science list. And what the science says is that it's warming, and we know that it can't be explained by natural factors. Natural factors, if anything, would have been causing slight cooling. And, you know, you can go through the litany, and pretty soon you'll realize that it's like the heads of a hydra. No matter how many of these myths and talking points you rebut, you refute, Uncle Charlie's just going to come up with another one. And what you realize at that point is it's not about the science, it's about the ideology. And at that point, maybe you try to get Uncle Charlie to think about this issue a little bit differently. You know, hey, you know, it's the investment community, the finance community, the national security community, 4-star generals, the Pentagon, who have said that climate change is an existential threat. It's one of the greatest threats that we face. There are ways to sort of change the conversation and frame it in terms of things that they might actually care about, things that sort of intersect with their values, where you can get them to realize that this isn't, you know, about granola crunching and tree hugging. This is about national security. It's about, you know, our economy. It's about things that most conservatives at least purport to care about.
Professor Oreskes, anything to add?
No, that was great. I don't think I need to add anything. I think we can use the time to take another question.
Okay. Well, thank you. Also, one more thing. Conservative Bob Inglis has done a 180 on climate change, and there are a bunch of interesting YouTube clips about him talking about this. So he could hear directly from a conservative, Bob Inglis. You can just search for that. Thank you. Why don't we spend the last couple minutes, you know, talking about some of the changes that could happen under a Biden administration. I mean, he's proposed spending more than $2 trillion to overhaul the energy system, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, transition to renewable energy. He's really embraced some bold policies. Professor Oreskes, what are your thoughts on this?
My thought is, I think that Biden's climate plan is great. I think it has many of the pieces that we need to have. And I think it shows that he's listened to people who know a lot about the issue. He's listened to the young people in the Democratic Party, and he's put together something that's very meaningful. But assuming he's got to get it through Congress. And we know there's going to be a lot of pushback, particularly from people in oil and coal producing states, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Colorado, you know, it's Wyoming, et cetera. And so he's going to have to build a coalition, and it's not going to be easy. And I think anyone who thinks it's going to be easy is going to be disappointed. And that's why I think the crucial part of this is going to have to be the piece to keep those communities whole, to figure out a meaningful program to take care of the workers in the fossil fuel industry who will be displaced. There are not many of them. It's a big myth of Republicans and climate deniers that this is a giant sector. Actually, it's a very small sector. Far more people already work in the renewable energy sector and fossil fuels. But nevertheless, those are real people, and they live in, and they have lives, and they live in swing states, and they're Americans. And so we have to take care of them. We have to make sure they're whole. And I think it's going to be very, very important to keep that front and center, mainly. As I said, there's not many of these people, but they are real people, and they will be used by Biden if he doesn't take care of them. So it's going to be very important to keep that front and center while also putting a price on carbon, eliminating subsidies, investing in a grid integration, and all the other great things that, you know, we've talked about, as you said, already talked about on this show many times before.
Right. And the Democrats definitely need the Senate to do any of this. Professor Mann, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, you know, as Naomi has said, it's not going to be rainbows and unicorns if, Obama wins. We're still going to have a monumental challenge.
You mean Biden? You just said Obama.
Biden. Oh, my goodness.
If Freudian slip, because it wasn't rainbows and unicorns when Obama won, right?
Right.
Well, no. And it won't be if Biden wins. We will still have a monumental challenge ahead of us. And the forces that are aligned against climate action remain very powerful, very well-funded. Mm. And so, you know, we can't be Pollyannish about this. That having been said, and you said, you know, the Senate, you know, if the Democrats take back the Senate, then there's some discussion about, you know, getting rid of the filibuster so that we can actually advance climate policy. One of the greatest enemies of climate policy has been the filibuster. It's been used to prevent meaningful climate policy, even when Democrats controlled Congress and the presidency. So we have to reconsider whether or not, you know, it makes sense today, given the threats that we face in the form of, you know, existential threat of climate change, whether, you know, the filibuster makes sense. And getting rid of the filibuster would probably mean that Democrats, that is the Senate, the House and the Senate, each of whom have put forward bold climate plans themselves, Democrats in the House, Democrats in the Senate, have each put forward a bold climate plan. Biden, as we have discussed, has put forward a bold climate plan. We can reach a consensus. We can get climate policy enacted if, you know, Democrats are able to take back the Senate and get rid of the filibuster and work with the incoming president. Now, if Democrats don't get back the Senate, then what we're looking at is maybe a handful of Republicans, moderate Republicans, who don't want to be on the wrong side of history. And I think there are a few of them still there. One could envision a potential coalition of Democrats and moderate conservatives putting forward a climate solution, but it's probably not going to be the Green New Deal in that case. It's probably not going to be the wish list that some environmental progressives might want. We might have to actually negotiate and look at sort of market mechanisms that some moderate conservatives can support and progressives could support. So everything, as we started out this discussion saying, depends on what happens in this election. And if you care about climate policy, if you want to see us act when it comes to the greatest challenge we face as a civilization, it's not coronavirus, it's climate change, then you need to turn out in this election. If you haven't already, you need to vote and you need to vote on climate.
Well, Michael Mann and Naomi Oreskes, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.